It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new candidate in the Democratic campaign for governor. How is that going to affect the race?
And now for something completely different.
What makes you think she's a witch?
Well, she turned me into a newt.
A newt.
I got better. Burn her anyway!
A clip there from Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Our next guest claimed you can learn something about history, art, poetry, philosophy, the media, and almost everything else in life by watching Monty Python.
Together, Brian Cogan and Jeff Massey are the authors of the new book, Everything I Needed to Know About Blank, I Learned from Monty Python. They're both faculty at Molloy College in New York. Brian, welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be here.
And Jeff, great to have you with us.
Hey, thanks as well.
So why bother going to Molloy or any other college if we can learn everything from Monty Python? Why is this comedy so rich with actual commentary on life? Let's start with you, Jeff.
Well, the Pythons were a terribly learned bunch of guys. They came out of the Oxford-Cambridge sect. They really filled their comedy with a lot of depth, a lot of in-jokes, and a lot of very learned in-jokes that come across as kind of crass and vulgar when they're on stage, but on reflection, they really come across as having a lot to teach us.
And it sounds like one of the biggest threads running through their work is this anti-authoritarian ethos, where they pretty much knock down the institutions that we are supposed to take seriously, we brought up to take seriously. Why is that?
Well, I would think that when they came from sort of this post-war Cambridge and Oxford sort of milieu where people are questioning the British Empire and the idea that, like, you know, you're supposed to be a loyal subject, you're supposed to go to chapel, you're supposed to do this and that. And then they look around, they see the robes and they see the finery, and they go, oh my God, this is really, really silly. Why is no one making fun of this? And then they sort of, like, you know, they translate that to institutions like the news, where, for example, they're saying, like, you know, the regular news is just as silly as if we make it news for koala bears or news for parrots. And it sort of fits in with the idea that these things are incredibly silly social construction, and Python is just sort of pointing it out to us. And, I mean, me and Jeff have always wondered, why can't we have a ministry of silly walks?
Absolutely. And why can't I just teach Monty Python all the time instead of medieval literature?
Well, I wonder, you know, in some ways it's so uniquely British. I remember watching, and there were sometimes references to British politicians, media presenters, and yet it caught on really big, obviously, here in the United States, too. How did it cross the Atlantic, Brian?
Well, it actually started on Channel 13, that's our local station here, but on PBS, a station in Texas picked it up, and they got enormous ratings because the thing is that, you know, there are an enormous amount of geeks, including me and Jeff here, in America. And all of a sudden, we're watching shows like Python when it comes to New York and other states, and we're going, oh, my God, this is what we've been waiting for. This is real sort of like, well, we love comedy, but this is like, you know, this is comedy that takes no prisoners. Comedy that asks intelligent questions, and comedy that really has no patience for sacred cows. And we thought, like, this is what we were waiting for all those years.
It's interesting that they say one of the tragedies about Monty Python, though, is that nobody really followed up on it once they made their entrance onto the scene and made their mark. It sort of seemed like there was nowhere else to go with this thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, SNL tried to follow in line after them and had some success. And obviously they were very keen on the Pythons. They had them on their shows repeatedly. But the anarchic version of scheduling or of the format just did not really translate well afterwards.
We've got another clip from Monty Python and the Holy Grail here. In this one, King Arthur argues with a peasant who expresses some unmedieval political viewpoints. Let's give a listen.
Old woman!
Man!
Ma'am, sorry. What knight lives in that castle over there?
I'm 37.
What?
I'm 37. I'm not old.
Well, I can't just call you man.
You could say Dennis.
I didn't know you were called Dennis.
Well, you didn't bother to find out, did you?
I did say sorry about the old woman, but from behind you looked...
What I object to is you automatically treat me like an inferior.
Well, I am king.
Oh, king, eh? Very nice. And how'd you get that, eh? By exploiting the workers. By hanging on to outdated imperialist dogma, which perpetuates the economic and social differences in our society.
Well, back to the theme of what we can learn from Monty Python. Jeff, the class system comes up a lot, not just in Holy Grail.
Oh, absolutely. And here we're getting one of those temporal mashups that essentially permeates all of Holy Grail. There are very few scenes in Monty Python and the Holy Grail that don't involve something from the Middle Ages shoved up against something from the modern era. And so here we get a sense of typical British, the king is the king because he's the king, up against modern Marxist theory. And they're playing up for jokes, but at the same time they're making us question why perhaps we still have a king anyway.
And it's something that it seemed like was particularly rich to them. And yet these were these guys who went to, you know, Oxford, for instance. These were sort of blue-blooded guys.
Absolutely.
Why did they decide to mine this particular vein so much?
I think because they knew this so well, or at least they of course, they had a smattering of everything, of Latin, of law, of medicine, of, you know, all these disciplines. And so they weren't afraid to just ask a question like, okay, what if, you know, we take a modern mediated environment like a sporting event and we apply that to writing a novel? So you have Thomas Hardy writing his novel. And of course, you have breathless commentators doing color play by play. It's a definite article. It's a Z. No, it's an Oh, my, this is an amazing, like, you know, new sentence from Thomas Hardy. And you kind of think, well, that's just as sort of ridiculous as interviewing a sports player after a game and, like, you know, well, we played really well and, you know, we came here to win.
Well, I don't want to knock your rendition there, but we actually have the original little clip of that. We can give a listen.
We can read
mine. And here he goes, the first word of Thomas Hardy's new novel at 10:35 on this very lovely morning. It's three letters, it's the definite article, and it's the Dennis.
Well, this is true to form. No surprises there. He started 5 of his 11 novels to date with a definite article. We've had 2 of them with it. There's been 1 but, 2 ats, 1 on, and a Dolores. Though that, of course, was never published.
I'm sorry to interrupt you there, Dennis, but he's crossed it out. Thomas Hardy here on the first day of his new novel has crossed out the only word he's written so far, and he's gazing off into space. Oh, dear, he's signed his name again.
It looks like Tessa de d'Urberville's all over again.
But he's down again and writing, Dennis. He's written the again. He's crossed it out again, and he's written A. And there's a second word coming up straight away, and it's sat. A sat. Doesn't make sense. A Saturday. It's a Saturday, and the crowd are loving it. They're really enjoying this novel.
So obviously a great sketch and a great premise. Thomas Hardy writing his novel in front of a stadium full of people who could, you know, in real life would have cared less to watch this guy writing. But what are we learning from that?
I think if you've never heard of Thomas Hardy before, and I didn't, I think, when I was 13 and hearing it for the first time, laughing anyway, that there was a guy named Thomas Hardy. He wrote some novels. One of them was probably Tess of D'Urberville's. And that somebody could treat him terribly, terribly seriously. And then we also start thinking about why it is, or we're questioning perhaps why we venerate sports figures and we don't venerate artists. It's equally ridiculous if we did, but why don't we? Why do we privilege one type of activity over the other as a group, as a mass of people?
Yeah, and to also think that, like, what we do is we're looking for heroes. And we usually look for people who excel at certain things. And to think that, you know, Hardy is doing sort of like the same kind of mental gymnastics as any novelist is or as any poet is. And they reference Eliot. They reference, you know, like Hardy. They reference, you know, all different, like, poets, artists, like, you know, different brands of theory. And we realize that, like, you know, these people could be heroic in their own way, too.
Absolutely.
A lot of times with popular culture, we look at, we see efforts to make it as inclusive as possible, to reach out to the widest audience possible. That wasn't their goal, it seems like, from the start.
No, not at all. This was a very, if you get the joke, congratulations, you're in the club. If you don't get the joke, that's the door. They didn't seem to really have a concern about, you know, gaining popularity.
And no, they didn't. They didn't really like punchlines either.
Absolutely. They're terribly against the idea of the punchline and the laugh track, for that matter.
And what if you don't get the joke? Does that mean you're just left out in the cold of their comedy, that you kind of have to have some prior knowledge even to laugh?
Well, in some ways, I always compare this to Bugs Bunny cartoons. I don't have to actually know anything about classical music to appreciate what Bugs Bunny is doing with it, if that resonates. Mm-hmm. And I think that much of what they do, even when they're name-dropping a ton of, you know, grade level 3 British authors, is still funny regardless. The idea of Thomas Hardy writing a novel and talking about definite articles and parts of speech, it's ludicrous on its own. Knowing about Hardy just gives it extra depth.
We're talking with Brian Cogan and Jeff Massey. They are co-authors of the new book, Everything I Needed to Know About Blank, I Learned from Monty Python.
And we want to hear from you on this one. What have you learned from Monty Python? Did watching the Pythons expand your understanding of the world, maybe teach you about a few things? And what is your favorite Monty Python moment and why? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about what we can learn from watching Monty Python's Flying Circus. Our guests are Brian Cogan and Jeff Massey. They're co-authors of the book, Everything I Needed to Know About Blank, I Learned from Monty Python.
And we're taking your calls right now. What have you learned from watching Monty Python? And did watching them make you understand the world a little bit better? Did it introduce you to new subjects and new people and new points of view? And what is your favorite Monty Python moment and why? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go right to our callers now. We've got Darlene with us in Marshfield. Darlene, hi.
Hi.
What's your story?
I just called to tell you that we are avid Monty Python watchers, and as a third grader, my now 26-year-old daughter did her science project using the Galaxy Song from The Meaning of Life. We actually had to find the clip. We had been listening to it on the radio or in the car on a tape, and we found the clip, and then we had her practice all of the statistics that were listed, and during the rather adult scenes that you're probably familiar with, we made a big poster. We talked to our teacher, and she flipped the poster down over the screen so that the class wouldn't see that. And needless to say, she got an A, and today she works for public radio.
Well, good for her. That's a great story, Darlene. Thank you so much.
That's a great story.
Well, wow, what a great illustration. Jeff, let's start with you of somebody very literally taking what they learned from Monty Python mm-hmm. and using it in their education.
That's an awesome example, and I think that type of they might be giants in what current version of Monty Python songs like that. There's certainly stuff to be had in the middle of all of those sort of silly moments and some of the somewhat salacious ones. The Pythons were also very fond of synonymy in a lot of their songs, and so you can learn a lot about sexually transmitted diseases as well if you listen to some of their songs. Synonyms for dead, things like this, they pop up quite a bit. There's stuff to be had.
The parrot sketch is mostly synonyms for death.
Absolutely. 50%. Good euphemisms right there.
I don't remember the Galaxy songs. Can anyone sing a bar of it?
I don't remember the tune.
No, did I put you on the spot?
I'm not much of a singer.
We'll have to look it up. Yeah. All right, well, thanks a lot for the call, Darlene. Let's go to Brian in Madison. Hey, Brian, you're on the air.
One of my favorites, it was in the life of Brian, and it was the revolutionary group, the People's Front of Judea, or was it the Judean People's Front?
Splitters.
And they were talking about, what did the Romans ever do for us? Mm. And then one of
the roads.
The roads.
Well, there's the roads. You got that.
The lines. The aqueducts, you know.
Well, you got to give them the aqueducts. That's true. Stable government. Must do that.
Thanks a lot, Brian. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because you guys do write about that in your book. Brian, what do you learn from that?
One of the things that they were doing is part of Life of Brian was a parody, not just of sort of religious, like a sandal epics, but it was also sort of a parody of the waning days of the British Empire. And so you've got sort of the silliness of the British Empire deconstructed through that. And what they apparently, what we've read from like what Cleese said later was, he's looking at all those splitter groups as sort of like the way in which the British left wing were all split, like, you know, we're going to take down the government this way. No, that way. How about this way? And so no one could ever agree enough to take the Tory government out of power or really challenge it. And it's sort of like, you know, if you look at it through that lens, you're like, oh, wow, I'm learning so much about like the stuff I didn't know before. And even like Jeff's favorite, which is the Roman guard, like deconstructing Latin.
Awesome. Romana ita domum.
It's interesting because you're not just learning facts, it sounds like, what you're saying. People are learning a point of view by watching Monty Python. And it is sort of this, like we said, this anti-authoritarian point of view. So does Monty Python graduate a whole bunch of revolutionaries? Is that what happens?
I don't know if it's revolutionaries, but it's people who, I don't even want to use the word skeptic, but are against authority for its own sake. And I think that's the part with the thing you did before from Holy Grail. It's like, you know, like, what gave you the right to be the ruler? And he's like saying, what's the Lady of the Lake? Threw me this, like, you know, sword, and they're from the divine ruler. And he's like, really? Like, that's the best explanation you got as to why you're the king? And I think it's they're not necessarily saying, like, tear everything down, but it's saying...
But they are asking us to question everything.
Yes.
We'll go back.
That's a very healthy attitude.
We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Nico on the line in Green Bay. Nico, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up with Monty Python. I grew up with parents who were huge fans of Monty Python. I remember hiding behind, like, the couch or something when they would watch Monty Python so I could watch it when I was all of, like, 6 years old. And I just remember a lot of the humor from, like, Monty Python skits was, it felt like a lot of shows like Animaniacs when I was a little kid.
Oh, yes.
Kind of seemed to borrow from that. And so, like, a lot of children's cartoons would definitely, were definitely influenced by it, just the humor.
Jeff,
absolutely. Yeah, no, I'll say it's not just children's cartoon, although I loved Animaniacs as well, and you can clearly see in many of their songs a reflection of things like the Galaxy song. But modern cartoons now seem to be maybe the closest we have to a Python-esque type of humor, with the mashups and the non-continuities and the split from one scene to another. You've got Family Guy and South Park, essentially, and some early Simpsons, maybe.
Well, this next clip sets up a little bit of the continuity, I think. An interviewer's worst fear here a little bit. Let's give a listen.
Good evening. I have with me in the studio tonight one of the country's leading skin specialists, Raymond Luxury Yacht.
That's not my name.
I'm sorry, Raymond Luxury Yacht.
No, it's spelt Raymond Luxury Yacht, but it's pronounced Throat Wobbler Mangrove.
You're a very silly man, and I'm not going to interview you.
And a lot of skits ended with,
oh,
this is too silly, or the colonel walking in, I think it was a colonel saying, I'm going to stop this sketch, it's much too silly. They didn't worry, you mentioned earlier, about punchlines. They really played with the format of how they went from one thing to another.
Absolutely. Brian?
Yeah, it's one of those things where, okay, we've set up a premise, we've got it out there, we've thrown out, like, you know, the idea that you're on an interview show, like maybe this one, and all of a sudden I'm saying, my name is actually Brian Cogan. It is Brian Luxury Yacht. And everyone's like checking their notes. Oh, did we not do our research? Let's check the title of that book again for a second. And that's Jeff Yeklept Yemmer. And it's one of those things where, you know, sometimes the silliness is not from the authority figure. The silliness is from the person trying to break into this realm of authority.
True.
And so the guest himself could be just as silly as the interviewer.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's go to our callers again. We've got Kelly joining us now from Milwaukee. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. I discovered Monty Python when I was in high school, and I will say that the philosopher's soccer match was what inspired me to learn more about philosophy. And as far as it's too difficult for me to find a favorite sketch, but I will say that I introduced my daughter, who's now six, when she was two, with the fish slapping dance. And that gets us laughing every single time, doesn't matter how many times you watch it.
Mm, that's fantastic. Thank you, Kelly. And you're inspiring me. We've just started sharing it with our kids. So the fish slapping is a good intro. What do you guys think about those two?
I think that's a great range she's got there.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
Well, fish slapping especially, you need no prior knowledge of anything to appreciate that.
No.
It is a sheer, unbridled, sort of like silly joy. It's just like, you know, is it a ritual? Is it like a hunting thing? Is it a mating ritual? But no, he's slapping the fish, and of course, the larger fish comes out.
And Michael Palin's favorite skit ever, by the way.
Really?
Yep, he said if they were remembered for nothing else, he wants to be remembered for the fish slapping skit.
All right, thanks a lot, Kelly, for that story. We've got Dennis on the line in Seymour now. Dennis, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I guess that Monty Python was my first exposure to humor other than American, and I realized that, you know, I guess funny is funny no matter where it comes from. And I also learned that I don't like spam.
Spam. Brian, universality of humor, he says he learned there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think Python is universal. By the way, we have a can of spam. actually, I did that. I brought that from Spam-A-Lot. And I have it, and it's on my sort of like my dresser at home, and I keep looking at it and thinking, the expiration date is way beyond where it should be eaten. At what point do I actually eat the spam? And that's been my sort of existential dilemma for the last 7 years or so.
You can always buy new spam.
No. That would be beside the point entirely. I have to risk it.
Is there actually new spam, or is it simply the same vat of spam in a new can?
Yeah, they put it in fresh cans, I think.
Is that it? Very efficient.
You know, in our last 30 seconds here, do you guys want to share your favorite of all time Monty Python sketch? Jeff, why don't you go first?
I'm a medievalist by trade, so I'm going to cop out and just say all of Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Okay, good choice. And Brian?
As a media studies person and a media ecologist, I have so many. The news for wombats is one. But one of the favorites is the interviewer with the sports star who has the monosyllabic answers and these long, like, involved questions. And that's like his answer is like, I'm opening a boutique, Brian. Or I've fallen off my chair, Brian. Or I kicked the ball, and then it was in the back of the net.
Nice impression. All right, it's been a lot of fun.
Better than that one.
All right, guys, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
We've been speaking with Jeff Massey and Brian Cogan. Together, they're the co-authors of Everything I Needed to Know About Blank, I Learned from Monty Python. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, our guest tackled one of the biggest questions of the 20th century. Why did the Holocaust happen?
But first, Brett Halsey, a Democratic state representative, threw his hat into the ring yesterday for the 2014 Wisconsin governor's race.
Halsey, who's been described as colorful and eccentric, says he'll reverse a number of recent Republican policies if elected, including Act 10. He has vowed to make the race more entertaining.
Joining us to look at what Halsey's candidacy could mean for the race and for Democrats in particular is Kenneth Mayer, professor of political science at the UW-Madison and affiliate faculty at the La Follette School of Public Affairs. Kenneth, welcome to Central Time.
It's good to talk to you.
So we have Brett Halsey entering the race. How is this going to change things, do you think?
I actually don't think it's going to change things all that much. Well, what we have now is Mary Burke running against three what you might call just curiosity candidates. And of the three of them, Halsey is the one that has the most political experience. But I would be very surprised if any of them wind up having a material effect on the Democratic primary.
What about the argument that maybe having more challengers in the ring for the primary stage in particular sort of enhances the effects of democracy? Will it do that, maybe?
Well, it's certainly possible. It's conceivable that the candidates might push Burke a little bit and force her, as Halsey put it, to sharpen her game. But for that to work, you generally need to have reasonably credible candidates who have a realistic shot of winning. And not only are these three candidates not in that category, I'd be surprised if any of them get more than a trivial percentage of the vote.
Now, here we are. It's almost May. Is this considered late to be getting into the race?
Well, for these candidates, sure. And for Halsey, this is late. I mean, we're about 6 weeks removed from the time when the nominating petitions have to be submitted to get on the ballot. And I think that's indicative of the fact that I think if you asked Halsey, he would tell you that he doesn't have a chance to win. He's doing it presumably to put issues on the agenda, to talk about things that he wants to talk about. The other two candidates, we really haven't heard a peep from.
And are you expecting any other challengers to enter at this point? You mentioned a couple of other curiosity candidates. We haven't heard a peep from the others in the field, but anyone else do you think is likely to join at this point?
Well, probably not. There have been a number of potential candidates who have decided not to run, and these would be people who are more well-known statewide. They have more political experience, and the time to be thinking about these challenges would be late 2013, a year or so ahead. It's going to be difficult for anybody to meaningfully challenge Burke for the nomination. We're just getting too close to the primary.
And let's talk about the candidates you called curiosity candidates, and I think you're including Halsey a bit in that number. What is that, and what sort of function do they play in a race like this?
Well, in a relatively open system, it's possible for anybody to declare that they're going to be a candidate. And of the two other candidates, Marsha Mercedes Perkins, as best I can tell, she doesn't even have a website. And Hari Trivedi, who's a physician in Milwaukee, was an independent candidate in the 2012 recall, but these are people that, that have zero political experience. They have raised very little money, if at all, and I just don't think that they are going to have much of an impact. They don't have an opportunity to get their message out. They don't really even have a message, and that's not true of Holsey. He does have a message, but I suspect for him, not many people outside of Madison will have heard of him, and for people outside of Madison who have, the stories that they're going to remember about him are the stories from 2013, which are frankly erratic. We're talking about the disorderly conduct citation, the stories about his own aide saying that she was afraid of him when he was talking about bringing box cutters and muskets into the Capitol. And this is not the foundation for a serious campaign.
Do you expect him to garner any support? He is saying some things that some on the left would like to hear a candidate say. So is it possible that he could shear some of Mary Burke's support away?
It's possible. Between Holsey and Burke, she is trying to steer a somewhat moderate course. She's been a little cagey about Act 10, not saying that she would want to overturn it. She's been cautious about some other issues like concealed carry, and Holsey is just straight down the left side, and his announcement yesterday, spending billions of dollars on infrastructure, overturning Act 10, and refunding contributions that state employees have had to make. And it's conceivable that you might get some people on the left side of the Democratic spectrum to support him. But I really don't think it's going to be a significant percentage of the Democratic primary voter.
And as far as Governor Walker and the race that he's running, is there any chance that he will deflect his attention a little bit, or his spotlight, is he still going to be focusing strictly on Mary Burke?
We're not going to hear a peep from him about this. He's already said that, or a spokesman has said that that doesn't change his focus. And I think the strategy for Burke is just to ignore these candidacies and focus on her message, and I think you'll very clearly see the same from Walker, not to really get involved.
Now, if, as you say, Holsey doesn't seem to stand a chance and he's not really going to affect the races that Mary Burke and Governor Walker are running, why is he in the race? What do you think he can bring to it? Is he just trying to highlight some issues?
Well, I think that's that's the key. There are some issues that he thinks are important. Some of the issues that presumably he thinks that Burke is ignoring. And that's actually not unknown for candidates to get involved in these races, not because they think they can win, but because they want to participate in the discussion. And so in that sense, there's nothing particularly unusual about it. But again, I would be very surprised if any of these three candidates wind up having a material effect on the primary.
Why do you suppose we aren't seeing more prominent challengers to Mary Burke?
Well, that's the more interesting question. I think one of the answers is that there are a lot of people who think that Walker's going to be tough to defeat. As a candidate who has lots of experience, you wouldn't want to step into a situation that you didn't think was favorable. By all accounts, 2014 is going to be very difficult for Democrats. You have a midterm election with a relatively unpopular president. You have Republicans mobilized. You have the Governor Walker presiding over a slowly improving state and national economy. And I think the strategic context of the race is going to be difficult for Democrats. Not insurmountable, but it certainly is not the situation where a Democratic candidate is looking at this race and thinking that this is a real opportunity.
Do you see the fact of Brett Holsey entering the race as either helping or hurting Democrats' chances in the November election, or maybe neither?
Well, I don't think it's going to have a significant effect. It could play out. It could wind up helping Burke by allowing her to run down the middle and portray herself as someone who is more moderate than typical Democrats. It is conceivable, although unlikely, that Holsey may wind up pushing her, and if he starts to in the unlikely event he starts getting some traction, he may force her to respond. But I think my guess, and again, it's not even clear that he's going to get the 2,000 signatures necessary to get on the ballot. My guess is that this is not a candidacy that's going to have a sustained effect, that it's going to change the dynamics of the race.
And we'll leave it there. Ken, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was Kenneth Mayer, professor of political science at the UW-Madison. He's affiliate faculty at the La Follette School of Public Affairs.
The Holocaust, the systematic killing of 6 million Jews by Germany's Nazi regime, stands as one of the most horrific events in human history. But why did it happen?
In the 7 decades since the Holocaust, some historians have said it's unexplainable, and some people have said we shouldn't try to explain it and risk justifying what happened.
Our next guest takes a different view. He says it's vital that we try to come to grips with what led to the Holocaust. Dan McMillan has been exploring this issue for years. He shares his thoughts in his new book, How Could This Happen? Explaining the Holocaust. Dan, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much, Rob.
Well, as we mentioned, there's been a reluctance to try to explain this. You quote a Holocaust survivor, Primo Levi, warning that, quote, to understand is almost to justify. You don't agree. Why?
Well, because I think that if there's one thing that we've learned, well, there's a lot of things we learned studying the Holocaust, but that every participant, or at least every German participant in the Holocaust, acted entirely with free will, faced no threat whatsoever of punishment. Indeed, often was even explicitly assured that no punishment would follow if they refused to obey an order to kill. It was always possible, indeed easy, to opt out of killing if you didn't want to do so. So no amount of explanation can relieve these people of their moral responsibility. So that isn't a concern for me.
While there were other genocidal killings in the 20th century, you say the Holocaust was a genocide like no other. What sets it apart?
I guess what sets it apart is that the Holocaust was an absolutely complete negation of the idea that human life has any kind of inherent worth and meaning. And I guess what I mean by that, to give sort of concrete examples of that, it's the only genocide in which the population was targeted for complete biological extinction. The only time that an ethnic group was targeted for complete extinction, I mean, not only did they plan to kill the 11 million that they thought lived in Europe, but had they won the war in Europe and had been strong enough to overcome the U.S., we generally agree that the next step would have been to strike at every single Jewish population on Earth. They looked at Jews as if they were kind of like smallpox, a virus that you had to eradicate everywhere so it would never grow back. And that's kind of one example. The other example, I guess, is sort of the radical way that they denied their victims humanity, like by reducing them to the status of material objects and by characterizing them as vermin, as microbes, as bacilli, and so on. So those would be some of the concrete examples.
So starting to touch on some of the explanations people have offered over the years, was this something uniquely about the German people, about German culture?
I argue pretty strongly against that. I mean, there clearly are reasons why it happened in Germany and not elsewhere, and they're really rooted in some very specific flaws in the political system and also in a lot of bad luck that made it impossible for Germany to establish democracy until relatively late in the game, until 1918, and that and other factors helped explain how someone like Hitler could come into power. But historians, tried for decades to figure out if there was something sort of uniquely pathological or wrong with the Germans, and by the middle of the 1990s, we kind of all gave up on that.
Why were Jews targeted specifically? Anti-Semitism, of course, was nothing new to Nazi Germany, centuries even of anti-Semitic pogroms and other killings, banishments, things like that. But why the Jews specifically in the Nazi Holocaust?
You know, the specific sort of, there were so many different types of anti-Semitism in Germany and in Europe at the time, but there was one particular strand that led very directly to the Holocaust already, and already kind of began in the 1890s, and that was the accusation that the Jews were the creators of Marxism, that they were responsible for the existence of socialist and communist parties, and that Jews controlled an international conspiracy to dominate the nations of the world by sort of dividing and conquering, by setting social class against social class, by promoting Marxism, by promoting the Marxist theory of class struggle. And the question is why were the Jews a likely target for this kind of fantasy? about them as the leaders of this international conspiracy. One was simply that Karl Marx was of Jewish ancestry, and that's a convenient peg to hang it on. A second is that there had been a long Christian tradition of seeing the Jews as kind of the spawn of Satan, and you can see these secular conspiracy theories as kind of an echo of this earlier Christian idea of the Jews as this ultimate evil. A third point is that the Jews were an international minority with, you know, communities in every European country, and that kind of lent a service plausibility to the idea that they could coordinate across national borders in a conspiracy. And I guess the last was just that they were so successful in so many endeavors, and in particular in Germany in the years before World War One, in the media. They were very, very prominent in newspaper and book publishing, and that gave rise to fears of Jewish influence and the idea that the Jews had the ability to set the political agenda and promote Marxism through their newspapers. So that's, I think those are kind of the obvious factors that might explain that.
And I always wonder about the impact of nationalism, and a particularly radical nationalism, where you're defining this category of, in this case, Germanhood, and then you've got these people who don't fit your definition of Germanhood, in this case the Jews. This also often applied to the Romani, commonly known as Gypsies, Masons, mm-hmm. and others. Do you think that was part of the explanation of why there was a convenient scapegoat there?
Yeah, you know, I think the way that worked was that the biggest political problem in Germany from the 1880s down to 1918, where Germany is, it was called the German Empire, and it was an authoritarian political system where most of the power lay with a hereditary emperor, the Kaiser. And starting in the 1880s, there was a very threatening challenge to this political system from the Socialist Party, the German Socialist Party, that was the largest in Europe and that was very radical. And Germany's ruling class and its imperial government pursued a strategy of trying to contain socialism and trying to prevent its spread by, in effect, saying to Germans, to the German people, let's not be workers, let's not be middle class, let's not be upper class, let's not be aristocracy, let's just all be German and unite on the basis of what we have in common, which is our German blood. And one way to define the German blood is to say, well, the Jews don't belong to it, they're not of our blood. And let's pull together, let's unite as Germans against our enemies. And thus you had a very aggressive nationalistic foreign policy that was an important cause of World War One. And at home, this was part of the use of the accusation that the Jews were responsible for Marxism. The Jews are the enemy because they are dividing us against each other. Let's all us Germans pull together against people who are not German, including the Jews. I think that's kind of how it worked politically.
There's a long-running debate in history between the role of big forces and the role of prominent individuals. And I want to bring up Adolf Hitler here. Would the Holocaust have, I mean, it's hard to answer a question like this, but would the Holocaust have happened without him?
That's one point. You know, you're always on shaky ground when you talk about things that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Historians are usually reluctant to engage in counterfactuals, but you can ask just almost any important historian of the Holocaust or Nazi Germany. They all agree without Hitler, the Holocaust simply could not have happened. So he didn't do it all by himself. He had a lot of help, and there are so many other factors in hundreds of thousands of, to some extent, tens of millions of Germans who bore some responsibility. But it is true, without Hitler, it couldn't have happened. And if, for example, he'd been killed in a nearly successful assassination attempt in the fall of 1939, we probably would not have had World War II in Europe, and we certainly would have had the Holocaust.
And he tied together a lot of the threads you were bringing up earlier, the mm-hmm. anti-Semitism, the anti-communism. Also, you write about his desire for Lebensraum, room for the German people to live mm-hmm. in Eastern Europe, where many Jews and where a communist government was. He was the one who synthesized it all together in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, he pulled it together in a synthesis that I think most people at the time would not have found terribly impressive intellectually, but he was in keeping. There were a lot of other people on the right wing of German politics and also in the military who talked about the need for Lebensraum, that is living space, in the East, the taking territory away from Poland and from the Soviet Union so that the Germans could settle and breed large families and make Germany larger and militarily stronger. You know, his synthesis, pulling it all together, I don't think would have impressed anyone except that he was in charge of Germany and he was able to act on it and implement it.
You mentioned the couple hundred thousand people who were part of this genocidal effort. If you took everyday decent people, maybe from our place and time, United States 2014, you put them in a situation like Nazi Germany, is there something inherently about us that would step back and say, no, we're not going to do this? Or in that context, would we react any better than the Germans of the 30s and 40s?
Well, if we actually grew up in that context, we wouldn't be ourselves. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't be we. I mean, I think if you were to take, if somehow someone could crazily establish a dictatorship in America today, but with the American people being as we are today, with our commitment to democracy and to equal rights and the protection of the rights of minorities, such a dictator, no matter how powerful, could not find people to participate in a genocide and would not find that the American people would be willing to tolerate it. I think in that sense, and I think that's equally true of Germany today as well. If that answers your question.
But the people of Germany weren't uniquely monstrous. They were in a specific place and time that led them to something like the Holocaust.
I think it is true that the political development of Germany from the 1880s down to the point when Hitler took power was already very destructive. And, you know, anti-Semitism had become a political issue in a way that it never was here, and the German people, a lot of them were nationalistic in a way that was ugly and dangerous. That's never been the case here. But nonetheless, I think it's when looking at, I view the Holocaust as unique, but it seems to me that in explaining it, it's not that the Germans are unique, it's that the circumstances in which they found themselves.
We'll have to leave it there. Dan McMillan, author of How Could This Happen? Explaining the Holocaust.